Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, January 10th, 2020. South Sudanese church leaders are sounding optimistic views about the approaching deadline.
As long as the guns are silenced and that there is continued talk between the parties, especially the government and the IO, we do believe that there will be a breakthrough eventually.
And sports betting has become a big problem in Juba.
Maybe tomorrow I will not win, so I can go back home and then sell one of my animals and then I come and support my child. I have about 8 goats I buy and I have like 11 cows. Yeah, that with that money.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The UN Human Rights Office accuses members of the Lendu community in the Democratic Republic of Congo's Ituri province of mass atrocities against Hema community, which could constitute crimes against humanity. Inter-ethnic tensions between the Lendu and Hema communities over land and other resources have gone for decades. But the UN Human Rights Office reports that from December 2017 to September 2019, more than 700 people have been killed in the regions Duju and Mahagi in DRC's Ituri province. In addition, 168 were injured and at least 143 people sexually assaulted. UN Human Rights spokesperson tells reporter Lisa Schlein most of the perpetrators are Lendu and most of the victims are Hema. He says the violence could contain some elements of crimes against humanity through murder, torture, rape and other forms of sexual violence, pillage and persecution. The report says the barbarity of the attacks indicates the attackers want to force Hema communities to flee and not return to their homes. The UN Human Rights Office commends DRC authorities in addressing the causes of the Lendu-Hema conflict. It is urging the authorities to conduct an independent and impartial investigation into the violence to compensate the victims. Some church leaders in South Sudan say they are optimistic the parties to the revitalized peace deal will resolve all of the outstanding issues ahead of the February deadline to form a transitional government of national unity. The leaders are advising the parties to treat the issues of the number of states with care. Lucy Pony has more for VOA from Nairobi.
After reaching the midway point of the 100-day extension of the pre-transitional period, church leaders note the parties have made some progress in implementing security arrangements, but they say President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar must reach a deal on the number of states and their boundaries. Bishop Isaiah Majok, General Overseer of the South Sudan Pentecostal Church and a board member of South Sudan's Council of Churches, says he is optimistic if the parties continue working together, there will be a breakthrough soon.
As long as the guns are silenced and that there is a continued talk between the parties, especially the government and the IO, we do believe that there will be a breakthrough eventually.
Kiir and Machar are scheduled to meet yet again in Juba next week to assess progress and discuss the number of states and boundaries. They met several times over the last few months but failed to reach a compromise. Bishop Majok says the dispute over the number of states requires a holistic approach involving all South Sudanese, not just the principals.
For us in the church, we really do think that the issue of a state is the issue that it will take more than just 100 days. It is an issue that, in our view, should be on the ballot, really, after the interim period. So the people of South Sudan will have a say on it. It will not just be an issue that can be used as political football.
Paul Yugusuk, Archbishop of the Internal Province of the Episcopal Church of South Sudan, agrees.
Of course, states are not an easy issue to be dealt with. It's very difficult. But we believe that as South Sudanese, we really need to find solution on our own, depending on our context. The community has been involved in this. So it's not something that two gentlemen will agree simply on that.
Yugusuk, who also chairs the Church Leaders Mediation Initiative for South Sudan, says reports of forces moving into cantonment sites, the commencement of training in some sites, and material support provided to the training sites indicates the parties are making progress in implementing security arrangements, but warns that conflict could be on the horizon if leaders remain selfish.
The formation of the government, of course, this is a key issue when it comes to formation, where everybody is looking into that cake to grab a bigger one or smaller one. This is where a problem is going to start. And we don't want position to be really a problem. The country is first.
The church leaders are calling on South Sudan's political leaders to put the interests of the South Sudanese people before their own as they implement the agreement. For VOA News, I'm Lucy Pony, reporting from Nairobi.
Angola's president has earned praise for his high-profile anti-corruption campaign, recovering billions of dollars in stolen assets since he took power in 2017 in the oil-rich nation. But Joao Lourenco has also taken aim at members of the former First Family, who have long been accused of milking the nation's resources through their lucrative government-adjusting posts, an accusation they deny. But a new study by an economic firm cast doubts on Lourenco's campaign, saying it's a flashy distraction from a coordinated campaign of corruption within the new administration. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
President Joao Lourenco quickly earned the nickname The Terminator after he swept into office in 2017 and launched an anti-corruption drive after 38 years of cronyism under predecessor José Eduardo dos Santos. Last month, the government froze the assets of billionaire entrepreneur Isabel dos Santos, the former president's eldest daughter and former head of state-run oil company Sonangol. But increasingly, Lourenco's anti-corruption efforts appear aimed at the dos Santos family. Isabel dos Santos's half-brother, José Filomeno dos Santos, is on trial for his alleged role in embezzlement and money laundering during his tenure as head of the nation's sovereign wealth fund. That, along with the government's reluctance to prosecute the former vice president, Manuel Vicente, a top Lourenco ally, is leading critics to question whether Lourenco is trying to eliminate corruption, or if this is the same story with different characters. Robert Besseling, director of risk assessment firm EXX Africa, says his team of researchers has found evidence of the latter.
The guard in Angola seems to have changed, at least at the highest ranks of government. The same practices are still very much being pursued. And that's what we're seeing through the major families in Angola, including those of the president and the former vice president, who are engaging in rather speculative practices that could be described as fraudulent and dealing with companies that have had very checkered reputations.
In an interview with VOA, Isabel dos Santos denied allegations that she and her husband, Congolese art collector Sindiko Dokolo, caused Angola to incur more than $1 billion in losses. Dos Santos says she has never worked in government and that she finds the anti-corruption drive disappointing.
And when we look at how many cases has really looked into, well, I have to say, I'm very disappointed. I wish he had really had addressed the issue of corruption. Most of the corruption probably is connected to state contracts or connected to the oil sector and not at all connected to the private sector. So this is a witch hunt. It's singling out two or three people and for political reasons. You might ask me, why now? Why is this attack coming now? Well, the elections in Angola are next year. So this is the beginning of an elections campaign.
Dos Santos is thought to have a $2.2 billion fortune, making her Africa's richest woman. Besseling declined to comment on the merit of the charges against Dos Santos, but noted that in 2018, the government fought to keep then-Vice President Vicente from facing corruption charges in a Portuguese court. Portugal agreed to transfer Vicente's case to Angola, but he has yet to face trial. Transparency International ranks Angola as one of the world's most corrupt countries. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
From Johannesburg, we move back to Juba, where many young South Sudanese are engaging in sports betting these days, and it could have a lot of disadvantages. Some young South Sudanese say they have gambled away their money meant for school fees. One local economist says the sports betting will continue to expand so long as it is a profitable business. Manyang David Mayar has more for VOA from the South Sudanese capital, Juba.
A betting hall in Juba's Konyikonyo market is packed with young people. Each one holds a piece of paper and a pen, ready to choose football teams they think can win in today's matches. Juba resident Rengrok says betting is his full-time occupation. A few days before last Christmas, Rok says he spent 500 South Sudanese pounds to bet on 14 games and won 1,038,000 South Sudanese pounds when he placed a bet on a match between the Spanish football clubs Real Madrid and Real Betis.
When I checked the game, I get Real Madrid was given 1-0 at first half. I feel faint and I have like something like heart attacks. So that is why I close my data. When I close my data and then I go back to sleep, I wake up, even I didn't sleep. I wake up at around 1:40 minutes. So when I check the game, I get the Real Madrid won the game. 4-1, when I see Real Madrid won the game, I really having a lot of joys, and then I feel happy because at that night, even I post on my Facebook page, I say that thank you, Lord, because this is the first money, a lot of money I won in my life. 1 million I didn't get in my life.
He says he used most of the money he won to take care of his family's needs over the festive season, pay his kids' school fees, and buy some livestock.
Maybe tomorrow I will not win, so I can go back home and then sell one of my animals, and then I come and support my child. I have about 8 goat I buy, and I have like 11 cows. Yeah, that with that money.
Other youth say they have not been nearly as lucky as Rock in sports betting. Joel Wani, a first-year student at Juba-based Catholic University, says he lost a lot of money that was meant for his school fees.
They sent for me 18,500 pounds. I decided to misuse the money. So
on betting,
I only pay less. While I deceive my people, even I pay all the money, 18,500. I pay them less money, 5,000. Again, I was being sent $100. I changed that money with 32,000. So again, I was supposed to go and pay, deposit the money in the account of the university. So I decided also to misuse the money, betting one after the other. Again, the money got finished. Once. Now I was broke.
Wani says he could not sit for examinations because he did not pay his tuition fees.
It encouraged laziness, like actually for me, where you get me. I just came from home. I eat, I take tea, I came inside the betting. Today I came around 9. I can spend the rest of my time here.
The South Sudan government has not placed any restrictions or regulations on sports betting in the country. Juba-based economist Abu John Grang says, like any other form of gambling, sports betting is set up to benefit companies, not individuals.
Betting is just about investing money in business with an expectation of winning or losing. Betting is in form of gambling where you put money in and expect to win just through luck. Always, chances of you losing are higher than chances of what? Winning.
Grang says, even though sports betting is addictive and can lead to criminal activity, it is very popular in African countries. A recent Geopoll survey found that at least 76% of youth between the ages of 17 and 35 are involved in sports betting in Uganda, Tanzania, Ghana, Nigeria, South Africa, and Kenya. Kenya Interior Minister Fred Mutiangi said last year the government would, in his word, turn the betting industry inside out and would initiate changes in the betting and licensing regulations because of the harmful effects of gambling on youth. The South Sudan government has not announced any regulations on the betting industry in the country. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayar in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, press freedom advocates in Nigeria are sounding alarm bell about action taken against a local newspaper. Find out more when we come back after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how much sleep do you need to be productive?
Usually, I think around 7 to 8 hours of sleep, unless if I have to do something and meet deadlines.
I need 5 to 6 hours because that's enough for me to be productive. When I get enough sleep for me, I'm active in everything I do on that day.
6 hours. That's the sleep that I need. I'm always the last person to go to bed and also the first person to wake up in the morning. So I think 6 hours for me is good.
I need about 8 hours of sleep because after I had this work, the body is tired. And when I don't have 8 hours of sleep, I'll be feeling body pains and then it will make me unproductive.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. Advocates of press freedom in Nigeria are accusing the government of blacklisting The Punch, a leading national newspaper. In December, the paper criticized President Muhammad Buhari for allegedly defying the rule of law and illegally detaining citizens. Supporters of the government argue the allegations are vague and lack proof. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
A paid commentary published on January 1 in national newspapers contained President Buhari's annual New Year goodwill message to Nigerian citizens. For years, the government placed the ad in The Punch, considered the most read newspaper in Nigeria, along with other papers around the country. But this year it didn't, in what activists and press freedom advocates like Raphael Adebayo regard as a form of punishment for The Punch's strongly worded editorial against Buhari in December.
Until The Punch newspaper came out to flay General Buhari's government, they never at a time omitted them from their advertorials. So it is very obvious that they are taking a stand, you know, against the Nigerian people, because the Punch newspaper has taken a stance, you know, to stay with the Nigerian people, to stand with the Nigerian people, and to speak truth to power and to flay misgovernance and bad governance.
The Punch editorial strongly condemned Buhari's alleged refusal to obey the rule of law and the detention of citizens who had been granted bail. The newspaper was lauded by many citizens for its bold standing on the issue, and the government was strongly criticized on Twitter for omitting The Punch in its New Year's advertorial. But government supporters like Abuja resident Yusuf Ali Jafaru say the allegations are vague and lack substance.
I disagree with that opinion. Why I disagree seriously is that so many of these media houses, like I have said before, they don't balance information. They will go ahead and say and feature people who do not have idea about what is going on. But for the fact that they have hatred in their heart against the government, they will say all manner of things just to make sure that their voice is heard.
Officials at the newspaper declined to comment on the matter. Critics say Buhari's All Progressives Congress, APC, party has shown significant hostility to the press. But Ahazaya Abubakar, the director of news for The Voice of Nigeria, disagrees with the idea that press freedom is threatened in Nigeria.
Well, press freedom in Nigeria, as far as I'm concerned, is a relative term in general terms. We pride ourselves in Nigeria as the freest in terms of press freedom in Africa. By the grace of God, I've been to main economies of Africa, South Africa, Kenya, Egypt, Nigeria, Ghana. And I know the level of freedom that these countries have in terms of press freedom. And I will rate Nigeria higher than them in terms of freedom, particularly during this democratic era.
However, press freedom advocates will be watching to see what happens next. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
From Nigeria, we move to Malawi, where human rights activists have given the Malawian Police Service 5 days to arrest police officers implicated in the sexual assault of 17 women and girls during post-election protests on the outskirts of the capital on October 8. The activists gave the ultimatum Thursday when protesters marched to police headquarters in Lilongwe, where they questioned the police inspector general on the matter. Lamek Masina reports for VOA from Blantyre.
The civil rights group Human Rights Defenders Coalition organized the demonstration in Malawi, which attracted thousands of protesters, including women's rights campaigners. The protest follows the expiration of another 5-day ultimatum the groups gave police in December to arrest the suspects. Barbara Banda, chairperson of the NGO Gender Coordinating Network, presented the petition to police.
There are demands that we have made in the petition that the perpetrators should be immediately arrested and that the course of justice should take its place. And we are saying the police should go into action.
The NGO Gender Coordinating Network says it has recorded evidence from several victims, including 3 girls who said police raped them in their homes. Malawi's Human Rights Commission also has released its investigation findings that police raped at least 8 women and sexually violated several others, including girls, during October's post-election unrest. During Thursday's demonstration, protesters said they did not want police to provide protection, but instead asked the military to provide them security during the march.
So you can see this is really a show of anger from the women, that they don't want the people who are being alleged to have committed this rape to be the people who also give protection. So there's a conflict there. And we are saying police has got a lot of work to do to restore the trust with the public.
Malawi Police Deputy Inspector General John Nyondo received the petition. He said police launched a fresh investigation into the matter on December 31, which he said would be complete in a few days.
As we are talking now, they're on the ground. They must identify and make sure that all of those who were involved and who were reasonable think that they did it, they will be arrested and the law will take its course and they will be prosecuted.
19-year-old Agnes, who is not using her real name, is one of the victims. She told VOA that what victims need now is compensation. She says we already have statements recorded by the police preparing for the court case where we will provide evidence and identify those who sexually harassed us so that we should be compensated for what they did to us. In the meantime, the Women Lawyers Association, which has been offering free legal assistance to the victims, has volunteered to represent the victims in court. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
From Blantyre, we move to Uganda, where the country has been placed on high alert as swamp of locusts continue to ravage its neighbors. The locusts have been reported in Ethiopia, Kenya, Sudan, and Somalia, among other countries. Districts in Uganda's eastern region, which borders Kenya, have been urged to be on the lookout. VOA's Catherine Nambi reports for VOA from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
With locusts detected in the Kenyan counties of Mandera, Masabiti, Wajiru, Garissa, Meru, and Isiolo, there is fear that swamps might spread into Uganda very soon. Agre Bajiri is Uganda's Minister of State for Agriculture.
Due to the security situation in Somalia and northern eastern Kenya, that's Mandera and Garissa counties, and other factors, there are still large locust farms observed from Somalia and Ethiopia, with further separate inside Kenya. Since the current control capacity is limited, some of the swarms could move further western into Turkana County, probably by mid-January, with likely potential and risk that some swarms could spill over into northern eastern region of Uganda, particularly Karamoja regions that borders Turkana County in Kenya.
Bajire says Uganda needs about $1.4 million to spray insecticides should there be an invasion. Locust swarms can consume vast amounts of crops and grassland, leaving farmers impoverished.
The minister has communicated the office of the Prime Minister on the imminent locust invasions and requested Minister of Finance, Planning and Economic Development for provision of a contingency fund to cater for the aircraft fuel in case there is an attack, pesticides for control, provide for ground support equipment and support teams, and to continuously create awareness to the population in case of an invasion.
He says Uganda is working with Kenya, other nations and regional bodies to stem the spread of the pests.
Uganda is a member of the Desert Locust Control Organization for East Africa and is currently closely working and sharing information on the current status of the desert locust in the region. A technical team of two officers have been assigned to travel to Kenya, that is in the Wajir and Marsabit counties, to understand the current locust control operations, to subsequently share experiences and support the control efforts in Uganda in case of any outbreak.
Bajire says Uganda would not allow a repeat of a devastating locust invasion that happened in 1950.
The destruction was so bad. The ground was laid bare. I've talked to some old people who are young men and children then. They talk about how they would come and leave the green ground black because they shit a lot of fecal matter, and that fecal matter makes the ground black after they have eaten everything green. So the magnitude was so bad then, and this was because there was no capability.
Komayombi Bulejea is a commissioner in Uganda's Ministry of Agriculture. He says if locust hatchings are not controlled, they can pose a high environmental threat to the region.
A single swarm can be as small as maybe 5,000 insects, but can also go up to 300, 400 million insects. And each insect eats its own weight per day. That is 2 grams per day. They actually devastate the entire country.
The Food and Agriculture Organization says the locusts have already destroyed 70,000 hectares of farmland in Somalia and Ethiopia, threatening food supplies in both countries. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
That story by Catherine Nambi in Kampala brings us to the end of our show for this Friday, when I leave you with the song Chol Abiye by Abiye Jazz Band. Been listening to Abiye Jazz Band with the song Chol Abiye. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend and join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.